Thanks very much. So why the public record here? I've been working on field plots for a long time, and I'm interested in the problem of inference space and trying to get beyond these very deep, rich soils that our ag experiment stations tend to be located on, and thinking about the issue of relevance across broader environmental ranges than we often get on station. And so the public record, thankfully, in the U.S., we have a very rich agronomic multivariate public record, as I'll show you in a bit. And the topic in this particular talk is maize yield stability, which actually links to the conference title pretty well, Approaching Resilience. So sometimes it's too wet. This is spring 2015 in central Illinois, and we have very heavy clay subsoils, very slow water movement across the landscape. Illinois was originally mostly wet prairie, and so in fields that aren't tiled, we can see very slow movement of water through the landscape, potentially drowning the maize seedlings, inhibiting and getting in the way of field operations such as herbicide applications, so we can have problems with maize yields because of that. On the other hand, sometimes it's too dry. This is 2012 in Nebraska, and you all know that was a heavy drought year, and here we have firing in the corn. We can see often if you get a drought during the anthesis silking window, you can have kernel abortion, all sorts of problems with maize yield loss that way. And these types of weather anomalies are becoming more and more the norm. And in fact, NOAA came out with a statement that just that variability is the new norm. And we have to think about how to move forward in the face of that type of environmental variability. So the work I'm going to talk about today is the effort of a large team. And we all play different roles in this work. So Alwyn, the postdoc on this project, this mini-cap project, a multi-state project that is looking at cropping system impacts on maize yield resilience. So he did kind of led the writing. Melanie Kammerer is a GIS expert and data aggregation expert, and I'll talk about how we use specialized R scripts to scrape data from the internet. And then the rest of these fine scientists here were PIs at different locations in this project. And the analysis that I'm going to talk about here focuses on the four states that were within this project: Illinois, Minnesota, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. The reason that we chose these states, besides liking to work with each other, is that they span an environment and soil gradient. Okay, so from pretty much right here, we move into four soils on the east of this line. Illinois and Indiana are divided pretty neatly between alpha sols to the east and mala sols to the west. And this difference in pedogenic processes in soil history affects the production qualities of these soils. To the west, we've got the deep prairie soils of Illinois and Minnesota. And then we also have a north-south latitudinal gradient and quite a range of environmental variability across that gradient. I want to point out, just a shameless little pitch here, that this project on Wednesday is going to have an entire symposium discussing results from this project and ways of structuring a very large multi-year, multi-state project like this. So what I was interested in doing with this analysis is moving from K county all the way to the regional scale, using these public records, and in particular, trying to get at this idea of maize yield buffering, of trying to reduce variability in yields over time across climates, and what factors help to buffer maize yields over time against volatile inclement weather. So this is a multi-step process, and this iteration of the process focuses on soil properties, mainly moisture holding capacity, things that affect that, and soil fertility. Currently, the group is now working analyzing management effects on maize yield buffering, and then to cultivar characteristics. Groups such as David Lobel's have done a very good job of looking at maize yield stability in relation to the public record and actually obtaining some cultivar data as well. Okay, so for our county level maize yield, we went to the USDA NAS QuickStat site, and we downloaded our data for the years 2000 to 2014. And although we downloaded all counties for state, we only kept counties that had 10 or more years within that time series. So one of the things about data aggregation in these large multivariate sets is finding some kind of minimum thresholds for acceptance of data quality, thresholds for acceptance into the larger data frame. Otherwise, you get wild points. And so I think for any type of statistical analysis, data cleaning is important, but in these multivariate analyses where you have many, many variables, it's particularly important. And so you can see that the number of counties that we were able to keep ranged quite a bit. So, you know, Illinois is corn heavy, and so we kept 81 out of 88 counties. In Michigan, the northern heavily forested counties largely got dropped. In Pennsylvania, some of the higher altitude counties got dropped. But overall, we had 3,540 site years in this analysis. We were also using the Webb Soil Survey. We scraped the data using the raw Sergo database and then processed those variables in our scripts. We were selecting only the portion of the counties that were in the cropland data layer, so not other land use types. And we were creating weighted averages across soil types within the county from a 0 to 30 centimeter depth. The soil properties that we included in our analysis were cation exchange capacity, pH, matrix potential at 15 bars, available water capacity, which is slightly different than water holding capacity. Available water capacity focuses on plant available water in centimeters per centimeter profile. Soil organic matter, so this would be the proxy soil organic matter that Peter was talking about. Percent clay and sand, and then a plasticity index. And we kept that in there both because it relates to soil water holding capacity, but also the plasticity of a soil has a lot to do with whether or not you can work it. And if you had a soil that exceeds its plasticity limit, then you've got a soupy soil that's unworkable. And then the weather data we got from NOAA. Now, this was probably the most problematic to aggregate of all three data types. We had to do a lot of cleaning, and we had to create scripts for the cleaning because we're looking at daily means over this period, so many thousands of data points, and you can't do that manually. You can't clean that for every county over that period for every day. And so we had to look at out-of-range values and error codes and all that. But once we had a clean file, then we were looking from April through October within the growing season, mean, min, max temperatures, aggregating growing degree days, and summing precipitation. And so this formed another filter on data quality. And so we were only accepting counties that had three or more weather stations active during that time. So our number of data points, you know, winnowed down over time. Okay, so how do we quantify yield buffering? This is back from the 1963 Finley and Wilkinson paper, where they introduced this concept of the environmental index. The environmental index that they were using was with respect to varieties, so variety mean yields. The y-axis here is looking at regression coefficient across those yields. And so it's worth taking a little time to figure out this triangle. Okay, so if you have a low variety mean yield and you've got a regression coefficient above 1, it means you're specifically adapted to favorable environments. If you've got a low variety mean yield and a regression coefficient below 1, you're adapted to unfavorable environments. If you've got a low variety mean yield and a regression coefficient of 1, if you've got a flat line, then you're adapted poorly to all environments. And if you've got a high variety mean yield and a regression coefficient of 1, you're well adapted to all environments. The reason I'm showing you this is because one of the things we were doing with these data sets is creating derived variables from them. And in order to create derived variables that had meaning and interest, we had to come bring some knowledge to it. Okay, so Peter Hildebrand and Russell, they had the idea to take this adaptability analysis and apply it to management treatments. And so you might have these treatments, A and B, at environments with different environmental indices. The environmental index is the mean across treatments at a given location. And these regression lines in this model here overlap, or they interact. They show an interaction effect. And what Hildebrand and Russell, what their insight was that these interaction points define recommendation domains for these different practices. So we took this idea and applied it to thinking about growing a location where county was now the treatment. So this is a result of a linear mixed effects model across counties for these different states, where we were taking the state level environmental index, so the mean across all counties for a year. So when you're in Illinois and you're down at 6, that's a bad year. You've got a good year over here at 12 micrograms per hectare. All right. Now, what you see is that these different counties have different slopes. And so, for example, this very flat slope up here at the top, that's DeKalb County. And so it's almost not noticing whether it's in a good or a bad year. On the other hand, you're way down here in a very steep line. You're in Hardin County down in southern Illinois, and very strong responses. As you move from a good to a bad year, yield drops off very quickly. You can see that when times are good, everybody's converging up here. When times are bad, they're all over the place. Actually, you see in Pennsylvania a different pattern. When times are bad, they're all converging. And when times are good, they diverge. And I'll more about that later. I'll unpack that particular phenomenon. So we borrowed two terms from finance. I have until how long? 11:05? Okay. Downside risk. So here's minimum yield potential. This is how low can you go? So DeKalb doesn't go very low. Hardin goes pretty low. Okay. And then the second was temporal volatility. So we measured this in two ways. One was as the coefficient of variation, standard deviation divided by the mean. And so if you've got a lower CV over time, you're more buffered. And if you've got a higher CV over time, you're less buffered. And you can see potentially there might be a second mode here, but the mode for CV is actually fairly buffered in Illinois. So here's a map of temporal yield buffering. So actually 1 minus CV, since we're looking at buffering rather than instability here. And you can see that northern Illinois and southern Minnesota are in zones of buffering. And as you head south in Illinois, you begin to lose buffering rapidly. And in fact, this line right here is the southern limit of the Wisconsin glaciation. And the soils change dramatically. You just drop off a cliff when you get beyond that line. In contrast, Pennsylvania is pretty poorly buffered, and almost uniformly so. Another way of measuring maize yield buffering is using power law residuals. So CV is one way of standardizing volatility, but you can also think about it as log of the variance versus log of the mean, which takes care of the power log relationship between the variance and the mean. And so in this particular figure here, if you're at a given log mean, representing a yield, if you are deviating to the negative side of the mean line here, and your residual is negative, you're more buffered. On the other hand, if you're deviating to the upper side and you have a greater variance at that same mean, then you're less buffered. And the CV and polar metrics of buffering agree pretty well. For the sake of time, I'm just going to go through the CV results here today. And so how to integrate all these very disparate measures that we took. So we used a structural equation modeling approach. And it's interesting when Peter was talking about collinearity, one of the reasons we chose this was to deal with collinearity amongst variables. So you fit your models based on a variance-covariance matrix. And in my mind, one of the first things that you do to deal with covariances actually is to make some decisions about what you're going to include in your model. So SEM modeling, I think it's very important to bring hypotheses to the table and have a limited number of variables that you are going to include in your models. So I don't use these as exploratory models. I don't put in the kitchen sink in these. I have some hypotheses that are going to be tested with a limited pool of variables, and I also make a pool of candidate models that I then run against each other using maximum likelihood methods. Okay, these models can contain both manifest or directly observed variables or latent variables, and I'll show you some examples of that in a second. Another thing about these models is that the causal relationships that they portray are putative. Now, you know, I'm not going to get into arguments about causation versus correlation here. I use these models to highlight putative causal relationships that then I test empirically. And when you're evaluating these models, you don't generally use just one metric. We use suites of output and fit metrics. And so model selection doesn't follow a strict algorithm. It's a bit of an art in balancing these different metrics as fit. Okay, so when you've got just manifest variables in your model, you're measuring these directly, they're observed. You have both exogenous variables, so like x1 and x2 are exterior to this, and endogenous variables, so the most interior variable y2 is endogenous to y1. It's also endogenous to x1 and x2. y1 is exogenous to y2, but endogenous to x1 and x2. For the parameters that you're estimating for these SEMs include covariances amongst exogenous variables, variances for your endogenous variables, regression coefficients, which can be standardized or unstandardized. So when you fit within a variance-covariance matrix, you have the choice of doing either unstandardized or expressing as understandardized. standardized or standardized variables. These two books here, I think, are the best that I've read on this topic so far. So James Grace's 2006 Structural Equation Modeling in Natural Systems is an awesome book. And then this is an older one by Larry Hatcher. And I used the Laban package in R to fit these models, but he's talking about it in Proc-Halas. It doesn't really matter that it's, you know, a different environment. He gives a great methodological explanation of implementing SEMs. So one of the things about the way that SEMs help deal with multicollinearity is that these path coefficients end up including both the direct and the indirect, or taking into account the direct and indirect effects. So, you know, X1 has a direct relationship to Y2, but also has an indirect effect on Y2 through Y1. X2, similarly, has different pathways by which it affects them, and the resultant coefficients take this into account. In a standardized regression, the standardization is taking place in standard deviation units. Okay. The other thing that's included in these SEMs is latent variables, which are often referred to as conceptual variables. One of the things that latent variables do really nicely is they're only including the shared variance amongst those manifest variables that makes them up in that relationship. So you can consider this a pure relationship, right, or a pure factor right here. Okay, the amount that's not explained by that factor can be thrown into measurement error and unexplained error. So then that actually purifies this relationship here between your latent variable and your endogenous variable. And Grace goes into a really nice explanation of this. So in our model, we started with a global model where we included latent variables for climate, yield stability, soil moisture retention, and soil fertility. So we started with a pool of candidate models. And then we had from global models, including these latent variables, as well as manifest variable-only models, and then ran them against each other using these suites of metrics. What we found was that, in our case, all of our models collapsed to manifest variable-only models. So I'll show you some of the results here. Okay, so this is for Illinois. Black arrows are denoting positive relationships. Gray arrows are denoting negative relationships. Amongst the models, you know, very high support for this particular one. The chi-squared was just on the right side of non-significance there. So the maximum likelihood estimator for these fits ends up following a chi-squared distribution. You want it to be non-significant. So you've got an observed variance-covariance matrix, you've got your model, and then you've got the predicted matrix, and you're trying to look at the congruence between those two. So here we have, in this best model, maximum temperature, water holding capacity, influencing minimum yield potential, which influences temporal yield variability. So maximum temperature decreases minimum yield potential. Soil water holding capacity is positively associated with minimum yield potential. The greater the minimum yield potential, the less temporal yield variability. So water holding capacity strongly implicated. Excessive heat negatively implicated. For Michigan, with coarser soils, both precipitation and water holding capacity helped boost or were associated with higher minimum yield potentials, which was associated with reductions in temporal yield variability. In Minnesota, water holding capacity had a direct negative relationship with temporal yield variability, unlike the Illinois and Michigan models, and a positive association with minimum yield potential, which was negatively associated with temporal yield variability. And in Pennsylvania, we didn't see a link between minimum yield potential and temporal yield variability, but we again saw this direct relationship between soil water holding capacity associated with less temporal yield variability. When you take a look at the unstandardized relationships here, you can see strong negative relationships for all four states between county soil water holding capacity and county maize CV. And what was that variation in environmental index associated with? There was a pretty strong effect of drought in all states except Minnesota. So back to that different clustering here. So in Illinois, the reason that we saw that really widespread at low environmental indices was that the southern low-yielding counties were also the most drought-prone. So in a bad year, you got that spread. Whereas in Pennsylvania, the high-elevation, low-yielding counties were the least drought-prone. And so in bad years, they were more squeezed. When we looked at regional variation in water-holding capacity, yes, clay clearly has an impact when you're looking at semi-partial correlations between water holding capacity, clay, and SOM, but when you reverse it, SOM does make some unique contributions to that regional variation in soil water holding capacity. And since I'm running out of time, I'll just give you the message here. We believe this is a testable hypothesis. Now, can management-induced variation in soil organic matter help boost maize yield stability? This is something that we have enough long-term trials that have management soil management and amendment management that impact soil organic matter that we can begin to look at this. In our preliminary analyses, we see, yes, there's support for this hypothesis. Do I have time for one question?
Okay.
Okay.